Need to talk with someone about something you can't talk about with anyone else? You can talk to us. I'm Dr. Susan Block, your mistress of the airwaves, but my day job is director of the Dr. Susan Block Institute for the Erotic Arts and Sciences, specializing in sex therapy over the phone. Anytime you need to talk, whether you need serious psychotherapy or a hot phone sex experience, or a combination, my world-renowned telephone sex therapists are just a phone call away. Totally private, absolutely confidential. We listen, talk with you, advise you, role-play for you, fantasize with you, no fantasy is too taboo, and help you with anything from impotence to exhibitionism, fears to desires, fetishes to marriages. For more information, call us at 213-291-9497. That's 213-291-9497 anytime you need to talk.
You're listening to Radio Susie One on the World Wide Web. And now, here she is, Dr. Susan Block.
Brothers and sisters, lovers and sinners, artists and exhibitionists, voyeurs and connoisseurs, all you children of sex, and we are all children of sex, with a capital X. Can I get an amen?
Amen!
Can I get an A women?
A women!
Yes, indeed, brothers and sisters. We may or may not be children of God, Jesus, or Allah, Adonai, Brahma, Buddha, Rama, Dhamma, Dhamma. But until we start cloning ourselves, we are all children of sex. And we are broadcasting live from the little love church in Bonoboville. The Church of the Bonobo Way. And I'm shooting myself because it's hot. Don't get any crazy ideas. I know people like to just take a word and assume they know everything. I'm shooting myself with a water pistol. Holy water, brothers and sisters. It's good for the skin. Yes, indeed. Shoot water pistols, not AR-15s. Oh, baby. So it's my sweet 16th bedside chat of the coronapocalypse in the tradition of FDR's fireside chats. Yes, indeed. Shout out, by the way, to my girl, Anna. Anna, muy cabrona. Recovering in the hospital tonight. There's a picture of Anna and me and Miguel barbecuing wieners or something. Corn. Oh, yes. Anna, muy cabrona. We love you. Yes. Yeah, she's at the second level, and she should be still at the first, but she's doing really great. You're welcome. The energy. We give the energy, and she gives always the great energy. Yeah, all right. So meanwhile, the nepotistic narcissist, let's talk about Trump. Yeah, he wore a mask today for a change. So we have him wearing a mask. We always make him wear a mask in Bonoboville. This is our little Trumpy squeezy. And he has commuted the prison sentence of his old lover, pal, right? Roger Stone. Yes, indeed, brothers and sisters, there he is. Roger Stone, and he is a total fascist jackboot licking douche, Roger Stone is, and an embarrassment to kinksters, swingers, and cuckolds everywhere. Really, he does all those things badly. So, you know, I'm not a fan. But his was not a violent crime, and so I have no problem with him being pardoned or commuted, but only if we also release all nonviolent prisoners. And let's start with Chelsea Manning. She exposed violent crimes of the U.S. military, but she did not commit any violent crimes. And free Julian Assange, because, you know, he did the same thing. And in the good news department, the Supremes are making some great rulings. It's really weird. But we didn't think that they were good. But, you know, sometimes they change when they're in there. Pro-LGBTQ, pro-dreamers, anti-Trump, pro-female. Hey, hey, it's the bonobo way. And speaking of bonobos, tonight I am going to chat with some very amazing bonobo-esque guests. Yes, indeed, I want to really get to know these ladies. And so I do want to talk a bit about bonobo sex and female empowerment and male well-being before I talk to them, and why it's so important, and especially in relation to Me Too, you know? You too? Yeah, me too. And the changing attitudes towards sex. Ah, sex, right? If you recall back in the fall of 2017, the sweet pussies of Me Too, the reckoning, pounced like tigresses on powerful men with grabby hands, mostly little grabby hands, but some big grabby hands. And many of them were fired or publicly disgraced for their sins of sex and power. Meow! These pussies have claws. Yes, indeed. Now, very sadly, Me Too did not bring down the pussy grabber in chief. Though over 25 women did accuse him of sexual assault. Nevertheless, Me Too has been a very powerful, very bonobo-esque movement in many ways, a movement for female empowerment. And bonobos are the perfect female empowerment paradigm, proving that true democracy is not just a feminist fantasy, but it's a real, viable way of life. Yes, indeed. Practiced successfully for many millennia by our closest genetic cousins, the bonobos, and maybe even by our prehistoric hunter-gatherer ancestors. Like the Me Too movement, female solidarity supports female empowerment among bonobos. And that's one reason for female solidarity. What is it? Sex, with a capital X. Yes, indeed. That is, bonobo females have sex with each other at least as often as they do with the guys. And I'm not saying that we humans have to have, you know, more gal-gal sex, although, hey, nothing wrong with that, right? But bonobos show us that being gay or bisexual or pansexual is natural and good, really good for the individual and the community, as just as good as being straight, really. Not any way lesser than. And they're also pretty polyamorous, kind of like Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith and August Alsina, the latest little fun scandal that isn't really scandalous at all. You know, they seem fine. It's the mob that is upset with them. But anyway, there's another key to bonobo female empowerment and the bonobo way that sometimes I think that the Me Too movement could be missing. I don't know. I call it Me Too Plus. And that is male well-being, you know, the guys. One vital reason rape is relatively rare and murder is non-existent among bonobos is that bonobo males get laid a lot. Yep. And this is partly because the females often aggressively pursue sex, partly because they know they won't get slut-shamed. And horny bonobo males also can have sex with each other. Remember, they are all bisexual. Yeah, pansexual. And this, you could call it erotic abundance. Well, it just kind of cools them out, lowering their hormone levels of what we might call toxic masculinity. They don't got much of that. And elevating their aptitude for love. Love. So yeah, I think to keep Me Too viable and loving. Yeah, loving and viable. We need to factor male well-being into the female empowerment equation. But how? Well, it's complicated. Okay. But I have two great guests tonight with whom to explore that question and other questions. And they are an author and a pro-dom. And so first I'm going to talk with the author of a wonderful new book with a very long title. Brace yourself. What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Me Too. Essays on sex, authority, and the mess of life. And a writer and editor based in New York City, Joanne Wipijewski, is a former editor at The Nation magazine. And now on the editorial committee of the New Left Review, co-editor with Jeffrey Sinclair of Killing Trayvon's, an anthology of American violence. Written in 2014, which was, of course, the early years of Black Lives Matter. So my guest, Joanne, is ahead of the curve. And it just so happens that Jeffrey is my editor at Counterpunch. And Joanne writes for Counterpunch, as well as The Nation, as well as The New York Times, as well as The Guardian and Harper's and more. But it was through Counterpunch that she found me, yeah. And one day, one night, she just vrooms up to Bonoboville in her too cool for school 1963 Valiant convertible. Yes, indeed. Beautiful 1963 Valiant convertible. And we spent a wonderful evening hanging out by the car. There's Max, the captain, hatless. He's hatless, I'm like in sweats. And we just had such a good time at the car and at the old Bonoboville bar.
All right, Dr. Susie, we have Joanne on the line as well.
Okay, and we had a car side and bar side chat drinking and chatting about sex and politics and bonobos, and it was so wonderful. And now, here she is, Joanne with the Juicy. Joanne Wipajewski. Yeah. All right. Hey, Joanne.
Hey, Susie. How are you?
I'm doing great. You look great.
Oh, well, you too.
Yeah.
I don't wear a mask, though.
Well, you never wear a mask?
No, I wear masks inside.
Well, you know, yeah.
But I don't wear masks. Like when I just walk on the street.
Yeah.
I don't wear a mask.
Okay. You well, know, I'm inside.
I keep it far distance, and, you know, I don't go into too many places, so.
No. But you have your mask.
I don't have any mask to show, you know. I just have a basic mask. You know, the blue mask with the yellow.
Right. I know it well. I have a few of those. We have a community here, so we kind of work together and put on masks, and then I take off my mask to talk to you and tell you how excited I am to have you and what a wonderful book this is. You know, it's got a hell of a long title, What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Me Too, Essays on Sex, Authority, and the Mess of Life. And it kind of underlines how when we talk in sound bites, we miss the mess of life. So sometimes you need a long title.
Yeah. I thought it was a pretty good title, actually. I mean, the title essay, you know, the title essay is one I wrote in 2018 about the actual Me Too phenomenon. And that what we don't talk about is kind of a thread that runs through the whole book, you know. And so really the title of the book could be Sex, Authority, and the Mess of Life. I mean, that's kind of, in a way, the real title of the book. But the mess of life and what we don't talk about are, I think, the two main threads through all the essays.
Through all the essays, but we all know that Me Too is a catchy hashtag, so it's a good one to throw in there.
I thought possibly, but I'm sort of on the wrong side of the Me Too legions, so...
Well, I don't know. I think you're on a good side.
I don't think so, but...
You're encouraging the Me Too movement to be what I would call, shorthand, more bonobo, or more understanding...
And
if I may, it's just sort of summarize here, The book explores that messiness, investigating sex scandals and sex panics over the last three decades, from the Central Park Five to Harvey Weinstein, from Abu Ghraib to Woody Allen, and you've even got my old nemesis, Dr. Laura Schlesinger, in there. As well as my mentor, Dr. Betty Dodson, is in there. So you've got my pros and my cons, and you've just got a whole mess of great information and analysis and feeling, a lot of feeling.
Yeah.
And you start the Me Too chapter with a...
I was going to say, I don't see how you can write about sex without feeling.
Oh, I don't know. I think a lot of people do.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a mistake.
It's a mistake. I agree. And I love your passion. And so I wanted to kind of start off. I mean, we've sort of started off, but... You know, you start off your Me Too chapter with this passionate description of sex between a boss and an intern. Uh-huh. Hello, Me Too.
Yeah. So it's me.
Who's
right?
the boss?
I'm the boss. I'm the boss. And I'm a very young boss.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in my 20s, and the intern is in his 20s as well, and so we're you know, we're at a party, and I've known him, and, you know, we have these kind of nice chats and everything, and he was absolutely, I mean, a beautiful boy. I mean, he looked like Greek statuary, you know, the ass. I mean, just perfect, everything. Everything, sort of everything about his body. I mean, it just looked like an anatomy class or a sculpture class.
What about his mind?
Well, you know, he wasn't shabby. He wasn't shabby, right. But he was, but I think he was insecure because he was so beautiful. I think he thought people didn't take him seriously. And so I never really thought he could be attracted to me particularly, because I never thought of myself as particularly attractive or anything really.
Well, just, I like, billed you as very sexy, and I
thank you.
I thought you very, especially
I'm,
with
I'm
the glasses.
Just the rhinestone cowboy. I wasn't cowgirl, rather cowgirl.
Bling bling.
I thought I should give you a little something.
Yeah, yeah. You should, yeah. And you did, and I appreciate that.
So he kissed me. We were at a party, and we're walking back, and he kissed me on the street. And, you know, it's New York, and it was fall, and it was lovely, and he was a very good kisser.
Ah.
And, you know, everyone should just kiss a lot, I think. And
not right now. It's the corona apocalypse. Unless they're your significant other.
This is a terrible moment for kissing. But I mean, like, I'm hoping that we will be able to kiss again. And strangers. And I think, you know, kissing strangers is a lovely thing. Or near strangers. I mean, it puts you in the person's kind of orbit in a way. I mean, you kind of understand something about them. You understand whether they're something about their sensitivity and their generosity, I think, through their kisses. And he was a lovely kisser. And then the kissing went on, you know, and on. And then, yes, we were on the bus. We were kissing in the bus and on the walk back to his place and then in the stairwell of his apartment. And I wasn't going to go to his apartment, but just in the stairwell we were kissing away. And then I said to him, well, of course, you know, this means I can't give you the job. And so I brought this into that story because, into the story about me too, because, you know, all these things combined, except that the roles were reversed. I mean, I was the boss. He was the young intern. He was looking for a job, as it turns out. I mean, you know, I was considering him for a job. Now we were kissing, I felt, oh, well, I can't now, you know, it would be wrong. You know, I had some sense that it would be wrong. And he was shocked by this, you know, shocked. Why would it be wrong, you know? And I kind of thought, well, actually, I can't tell you why. You know, it just seemed like I really didn't have a big power analysis. It just seemed like, you know, you probably shouldn't be kissing the intern and then give him a job. It would seem like favoritism.
And what year was this, approximately?
1982.
Okay, so people weren't really talking much about sexual harassment.
No.
Or certainly, it wasn't like you know, if you had an affair with your professor,
No, I mean, I didn't have an affair with my professor. I just kissed my professor.
Okay, I had one with mine, but that's another story.
Yeah. And it was good?
It was good. Yeah, I mean, I kind of think it's part of the learning experience, you know? But I know I can't recommend that in the era that we're in now, but for me, it was part of my learning experience. It was as good as, you know, Shakespeare, really. Or actually, I should say Greek drama, because it was my Antigone professor that we were studying Antigone. So, so that was a very personal and revealing way to begin the Me Too chapter, revealing of yourself and revealing of the reader and what they think of that, you know, and how they regard it with the different types of characters that could be in those roles.
Right, because it seemed to me that if I was telling that story from the opposite way, if I was a man and the intern was a woman, automatically you would assume a whole lot of things that you wouldn't necessarily assume with the boss being a young woman.
Right. So let's talk about sex panic, shall we? Or moral panic, which you define, if I may quote some of it, a social eruption fanned by the media and characterized by alarm over innocence, stereotypically white women and children, imperiled. The predator is a lurking, mutable social presence, a menace against which the populace must be mobilized. Moving along, examples range from the fever over white slavery in the early 1900s, homosexual psychopaths in the 1950s, to serial rages since the late 1960s against sex education, gay sex rings, gay teachers, stranger danger, crime, porn, satanic ritual abuse in daycare, in kindergarten, and sexual abuse dug up from repressed memories, and AIDS predators, and super predators, and internet predators, and sex offenders as a separate category of human being. Okay? Pedophile priests, of course, and epidemic campus rape, of course, sex figures as a preternatural danger, emotion, swamps reason, monsters abound, and protection demands any sacrifice, including the suppression of opposing views.
You wrote that first. Well.
Well, you wrote that very well. I did leave out a few parts, but it's amazing what you pack into that kind of couple of paragraphs and what we're going through and what we've been going through for the past 20 years, or maybe you could say 30 years since the sexual revolution kind of got bought, I guess, by Wall Street, and since we kind of went into this, I guess, sex panic.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a kind of never-ending, train, you know. It just keeps going, and it changes dimension a little bit, but the features are the same. And so I wanted to, you know, there's a misconception. A lot of people say, well, a sex panic is only about things that aren't true. They don't exist. Like, okay, we all agree now that the satanic panic that sent all these, you know, daycare teachers to prison, that was crazy. You know,
well, except now we've got QAnon saying that there's all kinds of child abuse going on at the highest levels, and I don't know.
Exactly. And as a result of that, we have laws that are supposed to protect and defend the children against traffickers, against, you know, this notion that prostitution is just rife with children, is of course an engine for law and law enforcement, and the arrests of thousands and thousands of grown-up sex workers.
Many grown-up sex workers, thanks to Sesta Fosta. And the, you know, the shuttering of Backpage and Craigslist shutting down, you have that in your book. And of course, we've kind of lived through that. So we know all about that.
And we accept ads.
And we accept ads too in
and
our
we ask you if you are a sex worker
right here.
And we watch over you and
Speakeasy Journal, we accept your ads.
Yeah.
And online. But yeah, it was tragic that Backpage was basically indicted and that then Craigslist took it down, and there are so many sex workers that are at risk now or dying actually over not being able to screen their customers like they used to.
Right. There's just, you know, there was just another, there was an arrest of a guy who has a outfit in Texas. He has a bunch of he has a bunch of websites in North Texas that were used by sex workers. And he was arrested, and he's got multiple charges now, and he faces 25 years in jail. But it's all about, there's, you know, the government is making a big thing about saying that this is the first big arrest, first big breakthrough of SESTA and FOSTA. But he's not charged with sex trafficking. He's charged with facilitating prostitution, really. And we'll see what happens with it. It just happened a few days ago. I mean, in June, I believe.
Oh, wow. So one thing that you describe, you use a phrase from anthropologist Roger Lancaster called poison solidarity.
Yes.
Which is a very interesting phrase, because we all love solidarity. I was talking in my intro about bonobo female solidarity and how wonderful that is and how essential that is to female empowerment.
Yeah.
But it can be poison solidarity. I don't think the bonobos have that, but, you know, if they hang around humans enough, they might.
Hitler did, and so
certainly
did Mussolini.
Hitler did, and Mussolini bring people together in fascism.
Well, sure, it's such a brilliant phrase, and Roger Lancaster is such a wonderful writer and thinker, and I don't know if you know his book, Sex Panic in the Punitive State, but it's a fantastic book, and he coined that phrase, poison solidarity, to talk about, you know, a way in which people are bound together by negative energies of, you know, revenge and the desire to stick it to the devil, you know, stick it to the demon, to find a common enemy. And so Max is quite right.
The monster.
You know, Hitler, Mussolini, but lesser horrors of history have also been part of this, and we are constantly seeing examples of this poison solidarity, where people really aren't coming together to sort of you know, find the common kind of love, but rather to stick it to the bad guy.
So one, you know, example,
and
all that,
feel very virtuous in the process.
Yes, and one example that you use from history, which makes it easier for us to see, is white America lynched some 4,000 black people, mostly men. From 1877 to 1968, and maybe beyond, there seems to be some lynchings going. But in any case, what you're saying is it's impossible to think of sex and accusation, is your quote, and not think about race. And Birth of a Nation, of course, nationalized white panic, which was very close to sex panic. And the idea that an aggrieved white populace has a right to commandeer justice without a trial, you know?
Yeah.
And it is mostly white women's accusations against black men. And you write, I expect that progressives today presume that all these white women were lying.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I think you're probably right. I don't know if they were all lying. I think that most of them were lying. Almost all, but maybe not all, because life is messy. But mostly. And then you say something to the effect of, so what does that mean about today's accusations?
Well, yeah, I mean, if the concept was belief, you know, that if somebody made a claim, we must believe them. We must believe the women. And that was an iteration, actually, of Believe the Children, which was also the slogan during the Satanic Panic. But Believe the Women really meant that if someone is making an accusation, you're the right thing to do, the just thing to do, the solidaristic thing to do, really is just simply excuse me, believe. Now that's undergone some renovation since
Joe Biden's accuser.
Joe Biden's accusation. And the same people who were saying believe the women now try to really destroy, excuse me, Tara Reid and Tara say, Reid, yeah. Oh, well, we didn't say believe all women. We said believe the women, but, you know. So,
right ahead, you look great.
Thank you.
We like to watch women drinking.
I like to watch women drinking.
We have a fetish for that.
I mean, if I told you I had
Go ahead. I should have had something more interesting than water.
Holy water.
But the point I thought at that moment, I mean, before Tara Reid and before this renovation and now we're not so certain whether we believe everyone. We only believe the people we like, and we believe them because we hate the accused. If we like the accused, well, then it's a different story. And that says to me that there's no principle there, which is a very dangerous thing. But I brought up the lynching example in particular because I really, because it's, It everyone was believed back then.
Yeah.
So and it didn't matter actually whether it was true or not. And so the awful thing that strikes me or struck me at the time and still is that, you know, if it's irrelevant, if the outcome is going to be the same no matter what, then it doesn't matter if someone is telling the truth or not, the end is death. But what that means is for the person who actually may have been violated, who actually may have been telling the truth, well, their violation is irrelevant because every violation is irrelevant because every violation must be true. So therefore, I mean, every claim must be true. So there's no way of knowing what's true, what's not true. There's no judgment. There's no, and anyway, the punishment is heinous. So I think, you know, belief is not how we're supposed to operate in terms of thinking about what's right and what's just. And it's certainly not supposed to be how we operate in courts. You know, there's supposed to be evidence. We're supposed
now,
to
speaking
think about
of
evidence.
Court, you were there for the Harvey Weinstein trial in New York.
Yes, I was.
What was that like?
What a travesty. I mean, if anyone has a lover or a friend or a son or a brother who was convicted on these assertions that were not supported by anything else, and that were actually undermined by years of, in one case, 5 years of emails saying, can't wait to see you, big guy. When are you coming back to LA? Hi, postcard from, you know, Italy. My father's dying. I feel so bad. I need a ride. How are you? Hey, you know, I love you.
But you raped me.
You've done so much for me, etc. We listened in the courtroom to endless emails over years, which were only a tiny portion of them, in which they were, Susie, they were... they were totally banal, you know. They were reporting on what party she went to, on what dress she wore, on what movie she'd like to see. They were friendly. They were sad. They were banal. They were every day. They were totally every day. So then we're supposed to think, because she told us we needed to think, and she told the jury, that all of that was very, very elaborately constructed, that none of those emails were her real expression. They were all put up. She had kind of calculated very carefully how she worded every single one because she was terrified that he would destroy her. So wow. That's for 5 years. She wrote, and the emails are at 1:30 in the morning. At
terrified that the monster would destroy her, destroy her career, destroy her life, destroy.
While she's saying, when are you coming to L.A.? She's 3,000 miles away from him. When are you coming to L.A.? These are the days I'm here, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you know, I think, but it brought something. And then she talked to her, this was Jessica Mann, and she talked to her life coach and her psychic, and she told them that she had this in hand, that her Hollywood friends didn't understand it, but that he was helping her, he was going to help her, the connections she was making because of him were important.
Wow.
He was her client. She called him my client. And that her friends don't understand and her boyfriend doesn't understand, but she knows the truth. She has set the boundaries. And the life coach and the psychic were saying, you go, girl, you know.
Yeah.
But then she told the jury, well, that was all lies. All of that was a lie. Every email I sent him was a lie. Everything I told everyone was a lie. I'm telling you the truth now.
And they believed her now. At least they convicted her.
Well, I mean, it's complicated because the prosecution didn't get exactly what they wanted from that trial. I mean, they didn't get the worst charges, but they still, it's a death sentence. I mean, he got 25 years in jail. He's very sick. The other accuser also, there was nothing to support her claim. And, you know, there were also other emails and her diary and other things that cast doubt on what she was
saying. And you have the story in the book, and it's fascinating. Whatever you think of Harvey Weinstein, you know, it shows that you know, a jury certainly can be swayed by the mob, by what's been in the media, by the picture painted of this person as a monster, and maybe he is a monster. I don't know. Well, I've certainly met a lot of monsters in Hollywood, but
right, and he might be.
Yeah.
But this still, we have to look at if we care about the law at all, look at it as something of value in any way at all, then we have to say, okay, there are rules of evidence, there are ways things should proceed, there is presumption of innocence. Now, I don't think Harvey Weinstein could get a fair trial anywhere, actually. I mean, he was convicted in the press, and that was, you know, part of the problem. I mean, and that's part of sex panic.
Yes.
Sex panic is really a media panic, and it makes assertions. It says this happened. It doesn't say the mainstream media and the social media. And then you leave the story alone until the jury gets it. No, no, no. It's every day, every minute, every medium. And so I think it was very hard. I mean, I think what they did was actually, I mean, I have no idea, but it seems like they negotiated in some way, because they dropped the most extreme charges, which demanded, if they had accepted those, would have demanded that they do something that was completely insane. They would have had to find that the state had proven that he had raped a woman, Annabella Sciorra, 27 years ago, but the state can't bring a case against him for that because it's outside the statutes of limitations. But so it brought it in the back way and said, well, okay, we'll throw her in.
After all, she's a star. Right? Oh, I think we got frozen. What is going on? Okay, so I can't talk to her though. Okay. So interestingly, in Joanne's book, she also talks about a Harvard professor, Ronald Sullivan, who was fired, pretty much let go, because he was on the Harvey Weinstein defense team. And he tried to say that everybody deserves a defense, every defendant, especially unpopular ones.
Every defendant is not
deserves
guilty.
A defense, yeah. You know, and is not guilty until proven innocent, right, Max?
And that's what we're losing in this country.
Yes, we are.
We lost it a long time ago, but now it's just, they've taken over. And by the way, I never think it's the government. I think it's the people that run the government. You know, the good guys that run the government and the bad guys that run the government.
Yeah. So, I'm not a fan of Harvey Weinstein or a non-fan. It's just very alarming to me to see how he, you know, the jury pretty much seemed to have been listening to the media, both social media and mainstream,
yeah,
more than than what was going on in the trial.
And in essence, that whole trial thing to me is a bad business, a deal gone bad.
Yeah.
A bad business deal, really. She wanted fame and fortune. He had money and power. Hey, sounds good. You know, what do I have to give?
Well, and she didn't get the fame and fortune,
well,
I guess.
Yeah.
Anyway, I know less about that than some other things. I guess I'll talk about a different type of sex scandal, which she has in her book. And she has many different types of sex scandals. And this one was one that went on in 2004, I believe it was. And it was an offshoot of the war on Iraq, what I call the rape of Iraq, just to keep our sexual metaphors going. And then we had this phenomenon that I called Bush's POW porn, which is what went on at Abu Ghraib. And I did this collage inspired by this POW porn, which I call Theater of Cruelty, because that is really what this was, a just very elaborate and crazy theater of cruelty. But it was extremely connected to the war itself, to the bombing itself. And of course, Bush, he said he was disgusted, although I think, you know, this is kind of probably what turns him on, actually. I kind of think so. That's why I put the religious imagery in with it, too. And you notice Dick Cheney has the sign of the devil. And anyway, Joanne has this great chapter on Abu Ghraib and the trial of Lindy England, who was the young woman here who was in a lot of the pictures. A lot of the high mucky mucks weren't so upset about what they did so much as that they took pictures of it. But of course, a lot of people like to take pictures, and so she took pictures, and they took pictures, and she was really just following orders. Maybe she should have said, I won't do this, because this is beyond the pale. But she's 21 and not exactly a rocket scientist. But, this whole thing was blamed on people like Lindy England and the high mucky mucks, highest of whom would be Dick Cheney and Pussy Bush, you know, George W. And I say pussy, but really pussy is a compliment. This guy in some ways was worse than Trump. He certainly bombed a lot of people, although Trump is catching up by killing people through COVID. But Bush, you know, bombed the crap out of Iraq and Afghanistan, and what did we get out of it? Nothing. And we got a lot of bad juju, you know, and killed a lot of people, our people, their people. Anyway, read this book for this amazing chapter, and also check out drsusanblock.com for this amazing collage. Yes, and Counterpunch, where I have my Bush's POW porn.
And that
article
was from an art exhibit.
Yes.
At our gallery.
We had this art exhibit at our gallery, in the art exhibit. Yes,
yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So Yes. Is Joanne back?
We're good.
There she is. Okay, well, I dealt with talking about Abu Ghraib, so we don't have to.
I just want to say one thing in case you didn't note it. I mean, and that's the, I mean, I suppose you must have, which is that that's the only thing that people were charged with. They were only charged with sex-related crimes. They weren't charged with what they did for their work. They were charged with what they did on their off hours.
Right. I've always said rape is a terrible thing, but murder is worse.
Yeah.
A lot worse.
Well, they didn't murder anyone, but the people who did murder people are just...
Yeah, they didn't.
Yeah.
But they got punished for because their treatment was somewhat sexual. You know,
yeah.
Maybe somebody got off on it.
They said it was deviant.
Yeah.
That's the thing. These were not regular soldiers. They were deviants.
But they were asked by the interrogators to soften up these soldiers.
They weren't asked to do any of what they did.
They weren't asked to do what they did, but they were asked to soften them up to make them more pliable.
What they did for their jobs was not what they were charged with. So you're right, completely. They were asked, for instance, to keep somebody awake, to beat the cell bars, to make a lot of noise, to put the, you know, subject them to sensory deprivation. But what they were charged with was what they did when they weren't at work, when military intelligence, right now, there's Linda England, military intelligence wasn't telling them to do anything about these prisoners. These prisoners were common criminals. These soldiers were just letting off steam because these prisoners had rioted because the prison conditions were so bad. And so they decided that they were going to have fun with them. Mm. And then the prosecutor said, "We don't torture for fun."
Okay. Well, I still blame Bush.
No, absolutely.
Even if they were having
fun. What I'm saying is, what I'm saying, the distinction only is that none of this, all of this could be denounced by the U.S. government because it wasn't their jobs.
Right.
What they did on their jobs, which was far worse, actually. This was terrible because it was humiliation.
Right.
But what they did on their jobs was actual torture, you know, sensory deprivation.
Yeah,
they were there.
Well, it's all torture to me, really, a lot, all these things. And so I just think that the people that belong in prison are mainly Bush and Cheney and Rummy.
Right.
You know, that woman, Gina Haspel, you know, that's
Gina
now in
Haspel.
Charge of the CIA. Anyway, before we go, I want to ask you two more quick questions.
Oh,
one
sorry.
Is, did you, oh, yeah, we got to go because we got
sorry.
Cut off. So anyway, Ron Jeremy is our friend.
Yeah.
He's been on the show just many, many times. I've known him for 30 years. Now he's in prison. He's in jail, in Twin Towers jail, arrested on accusations of forcible rape. I don't know what kind of rape isn't forcible, but anyway. And some kinds of assault or unwanted touching or groping or something.
Quite a lot of charges. 90 years, I think.
Yeah.
90 years.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
So did you look him up?
I did, you know, and such a complicated story because it seems like there's Ron Jeremy, the person who's arrested, and then there's Ron Jeremy, the character. And it seems that Ron Jeremy, from very much that I've read, it seems that he's being, he was accused in 2017, and there was a tremendous amount of pile-on back then, sort of about his performance at these various
conventions,
at these various events. And now there are many more people who have come out saying, Me Too, You know, yes. he hurt me too. But what I find complicating is just the relationship between what was expected of him at many of these conventions and what the fans expected of him. For him to be, as I think he said, legendarily crude, loudmouthed, ribald porn star, and that's exactly what they got. You know, and people wanted him to grab them or grope them, and he said to Rolling Stone, "Yes, I am a groper. I get paid to show up and touch people, and they touch me." So now he's accused of rape, and I don't know the details of these charges. But I do find this relationship between a person who's performing. I mean, because that's how he defended himself against all these other accusations, as a person who's been performing, versus and everyone understands the performance and nobody intervenes. Everyone says, "Well, that's Ron." So, you know, you know this better than I, but in the Weinstein case too, you know, everyone said, "Oh, that's Harvey," and some people went along with what was the unspoken rule of Hollywood. You know, you might get something if you.
And where is the line that you draw between performance and non-performance?
Well, exactly.
That's sometimes vague. I find that's difficult. You know, am I on or not? Am I performing when I go out and somebody sees me and they go, "Dr. Susie," you know, maybe I am kind of performing then and I do Dr. Susie things. So, yeah, I mean, that's a factor. There's a lot of factors. You know, sometimes he seems like the Harvey Weinstein of porn. But he's there in Twin Towers right now, and we just hope the best for him because he's our friend. And that doesn't mean that we don't believe the women or that we don't support rape or anything, and he's never done anything like that here. But, yeah, it just seems like it's a pile-on. So that's how it seems to...
Everyone has, you know, we have to say over and over and over, everyone is presumed innocent, everyone has a presumption of innocence, and every accused deserves the benefit of the doubt. And that's so central. So, you know, I don't know enough about the case, but I do think that it's rather amazing that... that one of the people who was very instrumental in calling him out in 2017, Ginger Banks, she said a couple years later, she said, "Oh, I don't want to be part of any internet pylon." But, you know, you start an internet pylon and then you are kind of part of it, you know?
Yeah, she's definitely the ringleader.
And she says that she's Ron Jeremy's policeman.
Yes,
policewoman.
I found that. That's interesting, yeah. Max, that she said
that
she's
phrase?
Ron Jeremy's policeman.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And she is.
Yeah. And she wants
citizen's arrest.
She wants to become as famous as the female Ron Jeremy in a way.
Something like that.
Yes. Our friend.
That's remarkable, don't you think, sort of embrace the idea of the police.
Yeah, yeah.
Time when we know that the police are running wild and have been running wild for quite a long time.
But this is a certain kind of policing.
The amazing amount of damage to people who are, you know, innocent and maybe not, but who the police nonetheless decide to execute.
Yeah.
Well, I've been through
this
that.
This is like
actually.
A public execution. I mean, I think that when you have lots of people... You know, people often say, "Well, there are so many. If there are so many people making claims, it has to be true." And you know, I've followed other cases and other scandals, and no, it's not necessarily the case.
Poison solidarity could be working its magic.
Poison solidarity could be working its, well, let's not call it magic.
Well, it's evil magic. It's that evil black, no, I don't, you know, just evil magic.
No, it's working. It's living poison. Up to its name. It's living up to its name. It's working its poison.
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Well, we'll keep you posted. We'll keep talking. Okay. But we do have to go. My next guest
about
is actually a pro-dom. Huh?
One at a time.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I just wanted to ask you, how do you feel in terms of, you know, Me Too has one approach to naughty men and dominatrixes have another?
I would love to hear. It's just a stiff pull on the chain. But I think the bonobos probably have some answers for us, too.
They do. And and we talked about that earlier. We'll talk about that again. I know you wanted to kind of end with James Baldwin.
Oh, well, there's a line that he said that I think is very important. He talked about the habits of thought that reinforce and sustain habits of power. And I think that everyone who wants to jump on a scandal, or everyone who is quick to make judgments, ought to reflect on that. How do habits of thought reinforce and sustain habits of power? And so certainly wanting to be someone's policeman reinforce the habits of power, I would say. The idea of accusation equals guilt reinforced the habits of power. And so Baldwin said, you know, what we have to strive to do in our life is separate ourselves from those habits of thought. And that means we have to be real, humane human beings. You know, we have to understand that life is complex, that people are strong and weak, and they're brilliant and stupid. And
sex is messy.
Sex is messy. Life is messy. And we have to sort it out. You know, it's important to sort it out for ourselves.
Yeah.
But for ourselves and for each other, not for some other kind of a purpose that really serves a repressive purpose.
Well, thank you so much, Joanne. And once again, the name of your wonderful book is What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Me Too, Essays on Sex, Authority, and the Mess of Life. Thank you so much. We'll see you on Counterpunch. And we'll have you back on the show.
Oh, absolutely.
I'd love to be. I'm sorry about the text.
Don't worry.
It happens.
Take care.
Yeah.
Take care. Be safe.
Poison technology. Right. Okay. So, moving right along from our author to our femdom. Yes. Are we ready for our beautiful, amazing femdom? I see her beautiful, sensual, sadistic mistress, Courtney. Hello.
Good morning. How
Good
are
morning.
We?
Good morning. You're zooming in to join us all the way from London, is it?
I am. I'm in London.
You're in London, and you look like you're in a London dungeon.
I am. This is my dungeon. We can have a little look around.
Very nice. Red brick
and
mirrors and chairs.
I have somebody
human.
Here. I
a
have my slave.
Human furniture.
Yeah, you know, he's very good. He's quite comfortable, actually.
He does look very comfortable, and you look beautiful just sitting on top of him. I love your... big leather, or is that latex coat?
I chose leather today.
Leather. Animal. Yeah.
Well, you know, everybody wears latex, and I like to be a little different.
You know, leather is very classic for a dom. You know, before there was latex, there was leather. Right.
Well, this is the thing. It's classic, and it's traditional.
And you seem so classic and traditional in a way, and yet so kinky in a big way. So what made a nice, classical, traditional gal like you get into kink in such a high-class way?
My goodness. I think I've always had a thing for the clothes. Sexy clothes, beautiful shoes,
yes.
And I've always liked getting my own way, and I'm a bit of a control freak as well, funnily enough. And I was actually doing online work. I was camming, and I came across, I had a few clients who would ask me to dominate them, and it came really easily to me. And I remember it was about 7 years ago, and I was doing some work with Spearmint Rhino in London, and they said to me, would I come and, you know, walk around in a little Spearmint Rhino bikini at Erotica, which turned out to be a BDSM event. And I spent the whole weekend there. I was only booked for one day, and I just floated around, and I was in my absolute element, and I just loved it. I felt at home.
Well, you are beautiful enough to be a model, but
well,
it seems as though you like the challenge of and you like getting your way. You know, models usually are bossed around, but you do the bossing.
I do indeed, and I like having a following. You know, a line of men behind me.
Should. You definitely deserve
who doesn't?
That. Well, I don't know. A lot of people can't handle it. They have people walking behind them, and they start running because they're afraid.
Because they're being chased.
Yeah. You have to be very sure of yourself to walk at the head of the line. And you are, somehow. Have you always been sure of yourself, or did you have to develop that?
I think before I started this, I didn't have a path in life. I sort of flitted from one thing to another. I was going to become a teaching assistant. I was going to work in recruitment. I was going to be an events manager. You know, there were loads of different things. And then I went for a photo shoot at a dungeon. And the owner of the dungeon said, would you like to come and work at the dungeon? I thought, oh, well, this sounds like fun. You know, I've been doing webcamming. I've been doing a little bit of domination. So let me try it. And I thought this could be a nice little a weekend job. And it just absolutely exploded for me.
All right. So what are your specialties?
Well, I didn't want to specialize in one particular area because I feel that an activity can be fun depending on who you're doing it with.
Okay. What would you like to do with your slave there? What could you do?
So my slave here today, he's very diverse. He kind of does what I tell him to. But we're going to do a little whipping with him, maybe some trampling. And, you know, when we're done with him, we can just throw him in the cage and throw him away.
Wow, he's a throwaway slave. Okay.
He's a throwaway slave. You know, he's just here to be used and then tossed aside. I might give him a hug if he's lucky.
So we were talking earlier about the Me Too movement. Are you into the Me Too movement, or do you...
I am.
You are. And, I mean, I would say that both femdoms and Me Too people are into kind of punishing naughty males.
Yes.
I mean, naughty being a general word, either or you know, really bad males or just mildly disobedient. I mean, the full range. Mm-hmm. And you do it, I mean, you might be in the Me Too movement, but as a dom, you punish males very differently than the Me Too movement punishes males. Mm-hmm. But I guess I'm just wondering, what is your sort of method for figuring out how to punish males? And are you really punishing them for being bad, or are you just doing it because that's what they're paying for?
Well, I feel that I have two sides to what I do. I have the side of me that offers professional sessions. So I am ultimately a service provider.
Yes.
Somebody emails me, they say, Mistress, I'm into strap-on and I like a little bit of caning. And I plan a session based around those activities to provide a safe place for somebody to come and lose themselves in their ideal fantasy. I then have the other part where I go and I have some personal slaves and I go and I film. And when I'm filming, I'm doing the things that I want to do. So, for example, I go to the Otherworld Kingdom in Prague, and I sometimes go for up to a week, and I'm fully immersed in the femdom lifestyle. So I'm not providing sessions, I'm not offering a service, I am living the lifestyle. And it's a fantastic and wonderful feeling, but they're both very different.
Right.
So when I'm doing more lifestyle things, it is absolutely all about me, what I want to do, high protocol. If you don't adhere to what I'm setting you, there will be consequences.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the sessions are planned and produced to appeal to somebody's desires, if that makes sense.
It makes total sense.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can see it. I mean, you are a service provider when you're doing sessions, mm-hmm. and you're, as long as it's not something that you really dislike, you'll
Absolutely.
Work out how to do it in a way you like it, because that's what mm-hmm. the client's paying for. But when you're doing videos, you do what you mm-hmm. like. And mm-hmm. I guess what you're kind of good at, what you feel comfortable with. Does any of it, like, turn you on to the point that you either have an orgasm there or maybe later thinking about it?
Absolutely. You know, it's, I get off on the power and the control and, you know, feeling desired, because one of I personally don't session naked, because, you know, they don't deserve that. So for me, that's such a turn on when I have somebody who's kneeling in front of me and I can see they're excited, their cock is hard, you know, they desire me, what we're doing, the energy that flows back and forth between two beings is phenomenal. And you can I come out of a session or filming or a playtime just feeling so exhilarated, and, you know, the adrenaline is such a high. And so that for me is a huge turn on.
Great.
And I'm lucky I have somebody who I have at home who I can kind of come in and we can sort those
really
things out.
Is that a husband or a wife or
no,
just a special
My boyfriend, I suppose.
Boyfriend, okay. That sounds so sweet. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Is he jealous? He's not jealous of what you do, that you whack other men in the balls or the butt or whatever?
He loves it. He's actually here holding the camera at the moment.
He gets turned on by it. Okay.
Yeah.
He's holding the camera.
Yeah, he is.
He's holding the camera.
Thank you for sharing the beautiful Mistress Courtney with us. Yeah, do you play BDSM games with him, or you have pretty vanilla sex?
Not really. It's more neutral.
Uh-huh,
you know,
okay.
We're kinky, and we like to try different things, bits of equipment. You know, if I get a new piece of equipment in here, we'll come and try it. But I have no interest in having a partner who I have to discipline or, you know, boss around.
So this is your job and your hobby, you could say, or your art.
Absolutely.
I would say your art.
Yes.
I think you're an artist in a way, a performance mm-hmm. artist. And I've seen your videos. We're going to show some of one mm-hmm. of your videos soon. But I just feel like we've been talking about Me Too, and I feel the Me Too movement can learn a lot from mm-hmm. the bonobo apes. And I also feel the Me Too movement can learn a lot from dominatrixes. I think that the Me Too movement mm-hmm. can not exactly do what you do, not necessarily wear mm-hmm. leather and whack people, but there's a certain dynamic of maintaining power and yet, mm-hmm. you know, keeping your slave happy.
Absolutely, and it's finding that right balance.
Right.
And it's very important. It's sometimes tricky to do, especially when you don't know somebody very well. And
yes.
I think that's where problems can arise.
Always. You know, whether we're talking about BDSM or the rest of life, the problems arise when you don't know people. But on the other hand, not knowing people, and this is a bonobo thing, is exciting. You know, the first time is exciting. So, you know, it's not like we want to do away with that. Although nowadays in the corona apocalypse, it's probably best to just play with people you know very well. So speaking of which, can we see you whack your slave there, your furniture?
Oh, are you asleep or awake, slave? let's wake him up, shall we?
Yes.
Come on, stand up for me. Come over here. Come on.
He's closed.
Over we go. I'm just going to... It's very warm now.
Yes, it is here too. Hot.
So, let's just tie him up.
Yeah.
So he doesn't run away from me.
You're looking good. You could show this part on Facebook if you want. I think you could... Yes. Yeah.
So we'll just do something light, you know. It's we can start off lightly. And he's got such lovely white skin. This is one of the things I love about CP, is being able to change the color of somebody's skin to this bright, stinging red. Hmm? Very exhilarating. So we'll just start.
Whack, whack,
whack. Just warm up that skin a little bit. Then.
Whoa. She's thrashing him. Oh, yeah. Definitely giving him some flogging.
Ooh.
And then a little a lovely special red care. Tinge. Yeah, you know, whatever you whack, I notice you do give wonderful aftercare or in-between care.
It's important.
Care. It is.
You know, it's ideally the mixture of pleasure and pain is what's exhilarating.
Exactly, the mixture of pleasure and pain, and knowing the balance of how much pain to deliver and how much pleasure to allow is the skill of being a great dominatrix, professionally or for fun.
And I think that, you know, a lot of people just associate domination with pain, excruciating pain, and people rolling around on the floor and screaming and you know, ultimately the reason, or one of the reasons that we engage in play is because we're turned on, we're excited, we want to feel horny, we want to be aroused. That's one of the reasons we do it.
Yes, yes. And yeah, I mean, you, in a way, you can't appreciate pleasure if you've never had pain.
Absolutely.
So, but it's good for it to be consensual pain. In fact, it's necessary for it to be consensual pain. Nobody likes to be sucker punched, but
no.
A lot of people do like to be spanked and, you know, given pain in a consensual way. Although once they trust you well enough, you can surprise them.
Well, this is the thing, and it's about going on a journey and building a relationship with somebody. And you know, even somebody that you meet for the first time, I always start out slowly. We have to build trust, lots of eye contact, lots of touching. You know, you have to feel that trust between two people before you can fully let yourself go.
Yes. Wow. By the way, your boyfriend cameraman is doing a great job. You look insanely beautiful in that corset, miniskirt. Yeah, wow. Bare legs and high heels. And a little slave boy, you know, he's standing there, you know, tied up in his orange shorts.
I think he's falling asleep.
I better wake him up. Yep, wake him up. Oh, yeah, he looks
there
like he's waking up a bit.
Oh. And then he moves his back muscles and he's sort of so excited.
You like that twitching, yeah.
I like the twitching.
Yeah, you do.
But I think spanking is a fabulous kind of form of play because it
impact
it shows
play.
Excitement.
Yes. I did a fun spanking show last week, Spanking Sunshine.
Yes, I saw that. I was very surprised to see Sunshine getting spanked.
Well, you know, we do all kinds of things here, especially, you know, I mean, we have such great guests tonight. I'm just really giving it to my guests. But sometimes we have fun here. And I hope you come visit us when you come to L.A., which will, I imagine, be after the coronapocalypse. And we'd love to have you, you know, visit with us, right?
I would love to. I had intended to come this year and do a little American tour, and I wanted to come to DomCon. And, you know,
I was going to be the mistress of ceremonies, but I don't think they're going to... I'm going to be the mistress of ceremonies at the next DomCon.
They're only online.
Online.
Yes.
Which, you know, it's cool.
Yeah,
it's cool.
Yeah, everything's
great.
Online.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, people can't gather unless they're like crazy and they want to get COVID at a COVID party, which is what people are doing. It's just crazy. But in any case, you are fantastic. You're very eloquent in the way you speak about your specialties, and just damn gorgeous.
Well, thank you.
So where
I did get up early and
you?
Try for you. You know, I thought I didn't think my onesie would be very fitting.
No, you look great. And so, what is that corset? Is that also leather or?
This is leather. It's
leather.
I think it's. I have no idea where it's from. I'm very lucky. My slaves send me lots of outfits.
Nice. Okay. Where can slaves send outfits? They should contact you through your Twitter, or your Instagram.
Absolutely. And I'm happy to provide options. You know, a lot of my leather stuff comes from Leather Erotics.
Okay.
I'm big into my shoes. I'm wearing Cassidy's today simply because of the blade heel. So
look at those legs.
They're evil.
Yes. I like those a lot.
I have a bit of a shoe fetish, I'm going to be honest.
Oh, I'm going to show you my... I'm wearing red bottoms right now.
Oh, let me have a look. Oh, they are gorgeous.
Peep toe, red bottoms. Yep, I like the gorgeous shoe too. Yeah, I think shoes are an important part of femdom-ness. Yeah. Your birthday. Oh,
yes.
Send shoes.
So,
okay.
It's my birthday in a couple of weeks. I know I'm definitely getting some shoes for the birthday. Let me let him down before he falls over.
Oh, my goodness. You're so considerate. You know, here we are talking about shoes, and you think of your slave's welfare. Very good. All right, Mistress Courtney. You are sensational. Size 3, right, of the shoe, right?
I am.
Yeah. I saw that. You are just so petite and powerful. Yes. Can we see your feet? Can you show us a foot?
Sure, we can look at my feet.
Yeah, let's have a look at those feet. Mm. Ooh, look at those pretty pedicured toes. Just beautiful.
It might be a little dirty. Oh,
well,
dear.
There's people with a fetish for that. Yeah.
I know, I need somebody to come and clean my feet.
I think you'd get a lot of takers. I do.
You know, make them all
beautiful.
Nice and sweaty in the heels, and then have somebody come and lick the sweat from in between my toes. I love having my toes sucked.
Yes, I can imagine. You have a toegasm from having your toes
it's
sucked.
Amazing.
Yeah.
If it's done right, you know, teeth.
Of course. You don't want a nervous toe sucker. He's got to have a sense about it. Yeah, all right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back via Zoom as well as come to the studio. Sunshine's excited. She's been talking to you for a while. There she is. Can we see Sunshine? Yep, there. Whoops. Okay.
Oh.
And we think you're great. Okay, Mistress Courtney of London.
And I will hope you see you soon.
Oh, can you say listen to the Dr. or watch the Dr. Susan Block show? Yeah, you should say that.
Okay.
Just say
everybody, you need to watch the Dr. Susan Block show.
All right.
Beautiful. Thank you. Okay. And We're almost out of time, I think, Captain Max. Is there anything you wanted to add to the mix?
I need at least another hour and a half.
Ah.
You know, because it's very deep.
Very deep.
It's all deep. By the way, we should have told her that she can advertise her services.
Oh, well, we're telling her now.
In Bonoboville.
Yes, in Bonoboville.
Free of charge.
And in our next magazine.
Thank you.
And in our next magazine.
And she just said, why thank you, so she's still hanging around.
Oh, hi.
She's gone now, but she was.
No,
she's
there she
in
is.
And out. Our tech department is bringing her in and out.
Yeah, yeah. She's beautiful.
Oh, yeah. All right. So, or do I have to end when I usually have to end? Am I ending?
How many? We have 3 minutes.
And we have the video.
Oh, and the video.
We do want to show the video. But first I want to credit my bonobo necklace, which is from the Bonobo Conservation Initiative, run by my old friend Sally Cox. And this necklace was given to me by my wonderful client, Robert. And I just want to also thank the Bonobo Project for my I Bonobo You armband. And the Bonobo Project is, of course, run by Ashley Stone. And I want to thank Lolia Bonobo for most of our Bonobo images that we've been showing tonight. Claudine Andre, Vanessa Woods, and Dr. Brian Hare. I want everybody, please, you've been hearing about bonobos, donate to one of these organizations, Bonobo Conservation Initiative, the Bonobo Project, and Lola Ya Bonobo. And by the way, bonobos are susceptible to the coronavirus. They can get it too. So we need to help them to stay in quarantine, because that's what they're doing over at Lola Ya Bonobo.
We
Very
want to show
important.
The video.
And yeah, mean, so we are, before we go, we're going to show a fantastic little promo video of Mistress Courtney.
She's beautiful, the woman.
To
oh, yeah.
Kneel right here.
Oh. She's got 1, 2, 3 slaves in there.
Let's get your ass used to the king.
Feel your tongue through leather. To the backs.
Beautiful. And here she still is. All right. That's so great. And by the way, all you who are watching on Facebook, you were not allowed to see that. But you can see it on drsusanblock.com/live. Okay. So, yeah, I think we have to
That's
go.
It.
So I want to thank all my fabulous guests and crew, Joanne Wipajewski, Mistress Courtney. Thank you, Sunshine. Thank you, Captain Max. And thank you all who are watching us right now in our bedside chat of the coronapocalypse, inspired by FDR's old fireside chats. We try to help you to get through the tough times with a little warmth and, well, a little sex. And I don't think FDR gave you much sex, although, I don't know, some women found him sexy, so maybe he did. So in any way, make like bonobos, not baboons, female empowerment, male well-being. And of course, we didn't talk about it tonight, but peace through pleasure, that's the most important in a way. Bonobos have never been seen killing each other in the wild or captivity, and they make peace through sexual, erotic pleasure and food. They also share food. They share a lot of things. They're the sharers, and we need to learn how to share in our society. So make like bonobos, not baboons. Make love, not war. make love to someone you love tonight. Even if that someone is you, I love you.
Need to talk with someone about something you can't talk about with anyone else? You can talk to us. I'm Dr. Susan Block, your mistress of the airwaves, but my day job is director of the Dr. Susan Block Institute for the Erotic Arts and Sciences, specializing in sex therapy over the phone. Anytime you need to talk, whether you need serious psychotherapy or a hot phone sex experience or a combination, my world-renowned telephone sex therapists are just a phone call away. Totally private, absolutely confidential. We listen, talk with you, advise you, role-play for you, fantasize with you. No fantasy is too taboo, and help you with anything from impotence to exhibitionism, fears to desires, fetishes to marriages. For more information, call us at 213-291-9497. That's 213-291-9497 anytime you need to talk.
You're listening to Radio Susie One on the World Wide Web.
With someone about something you can't talk about with anyone else, you can talk with us. I'm Dr. Susan Block, your mistress of the airwaves, but my day job is director of the Dr. Susan Block Institute for the Erotic Arts and Sciences, specializing in sex therapy over the phone. Anytime you need to talk, whether you need serious psychotherapy or a hot phone sex experience, or a combination. My world-renowned telephone sex therapists are just a phone call away. Totally private, absolutely confidential. We listen, talk with you, advise you, role-play for you, and fantasize with you. And no fantasy is too taboo. And we help you with anything from impotence to exhibitionism, fears to desires, fetishes to marriages. If you've never called before, don't be embarrassed. We all need help with sex at one time or another. Even world leaders do. Maybe especially world leaders do. But I'm not going to tell you which ones. So, when you need to ask a question or play out a fantasy or just talk with someone about something you can't talk about with anyone else, call us at 213-291-9497 anytime you need to talk.
Hi, I'm Dr. Susan Block, and I've just written a new book called The Bonobo Way, inspired by my love for the make-love-not-war great apes. You know, the ones who have a lot of sex in a bonobo sutra of positions, including face-to-face. But it's not just how bonobos have sex. It's how they use sex to prevent murder and war, really. They're the only great apes that have never been seen killing each other. They practice what I call peace through pleasure, with the females gently dominating the very happy, very sexually satisfied males. Bonobos are special, partly because they just are, and partly because they're very, very close to us, almost 99% genetically similar to us. When it comes to being human, even being humane, bonobos can teach us so much. Which brings me to us, and more specifically to you. Is your inner bonobo longing to swing free? Would you like to tap into the hot, natural sex energy within you? Bet you would. So you can better enjoy the pleasures in life and cope with the pain. You know, the pain. And have more orgasmic, organic, sustainable sex. Who doesn't want that? Greater lust, greater trust, and better anger management. And who couldn't use a little bit of that these days? So get the book, Learn the Bonobo Way. You'll be glad you did. Then you'll want to join Bonoboville, a new global village for bonobo lovers and friends. And one last thing. The real bonobos are highly endangered, so a portion of all book sales go to bonobo conservation groups working to save the wild bonobos from extinction. Read The Bonobo Way and learn why this could be the most important eco-sexual movement of our times. And improve your love life.